Now we have done the rebound and we have done the congregational meeting and you're up to speed. We will now continue with our first Bible class. Now what is this first Bible class? In our study of the clanking chains, we inspired a question in paragraph 8, Lucifer's global conspiracy, its aspirations and its failure. And the purpose of that paragraph was to clarify comments made about a global conspiracy and to establish they, global conspiracies, those comments regarding them, do not refer to human efforts or human organizations that appear in every generation of history. Human conspiracies that aspire for global perfection always imagine an utopian future when all men will be equal, Bambi's mother is revived, and there will be bluebirds over the white cliffs of Dover. That is where the cultural Marxist envision taking us. No human global conspiracy can succeed because the intellect and organizational skills for such a prodigious undertaking are simply not up to the challenge. Lucifer, however, does operate a global conspiracy and has done so since Genesis 3. It has been unabated. It continues at full force and is invisible. It is made evident only by one's ability to identify its manifestations through the lens of Bible doctrine. It is comforting for the believer to know that even though Lucifer has the intelligence, the organizational skills, and the motivation to pull it off, he will not be successful. His efforts toward centralizing global power under his supervision are evident in the church age, but they will fail. His efforts to do so in the tribulation will intensify and actually gain momentum, but these too shall fail. His failure in the church age is because of the restraining ministry of the Holy Spirit. His failure in the tribulation will be because of the second advent of Jesus Christ. And we have examined the biblical revelation of these facts from 2 Thessalonians 2, verses 1 through 8, but in so doing, a few questions arose regarding my exegesis of the passage, and we will now take time to answer them. Now, first of all, we have to get our vocabulary straight, our English vocabulary, that is. The Bible has no vocabulary problem. It is immutable. The Bible is unchanging and thus provides the absolute and unalterable data that we need in order to understand God's message to mankind. However, for non-Greek-speaking individuals, and by that I mean non-Koine Greek, there are various versions of the Bible in an abundance of languages. When translating from the original manuscripts, there are inevitably problems in the transfer from one language to another. Such is the case with the English translations of 2 Thessalonians, and we shall attempt to straighten it out. And we begin with the King James Version's translation of 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 2. It reads this way: "We ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had come." Now, Paul's purpose for writing this paragraph was to explain the details about the timing of the rapture of the church and of the second advent. False teachers had come into the church at Thessalonica and taught a false doctrine and attributed it to Paul. They told the church Paul's earlier teachings were in error. Paul had discovered this and had made corrections to his earlier epistle in a revised edition. The false corrigendum revealed that the tribulation had already begun, and the second advent was near at hand. This meant that what Paul had taught about the rapture in 1 Thessalonians was in error, thus necessitating the revised edition of 1 Thessalonians. The false teachers claimed to have this corrected version and were therefore making this information known to the members of the church in Thessalonica. This form of false teaching, by the way, continues down to this very day. There are three schools of thought regarding the timing of the rapture, and this passage, as well as a few others in English translations, contribute to that confusion. Now, I will show you a chart, a dispensational chart, with which you're very familiar. The ones that we want to isolate on today are Christocentric, number two, which is the church age, and eschatological, number one, which is the tribulation. These two dispensations run chronologically together as far as time is concerned. We are presently in the church age. It is the belief of this church that there will be a pre-tribulational rapture. And those of you who have your notes will note that that is the first category of the doctrine that I have noted. There are three approaches to it. The first that we've mentioned here is pre-tribulational rapture, meaning that the church age comes to an end before the tribulation begins. However, there are other approaches to this theologically. There are those who believe that at the midpoint of the seven-year tribulation, which means 3.5 years deep, that is the point where the rapture occurs. That is called the mid-tribulational rapture. And then finally, there are those who believe that the rapture will occur at the end of the tribulation, that the second advent and the rapture of the church occur at approximately the same time, the rapture occurring and then the second advent occurring almost immediately. That is called the post-tribulational rapture, and thus implies the church goes through the entire tribulational period. I reject mid-tribulational rapture as well as post-tribulational rapture. It is obvious from the passages that we're noting that this cannot be true. However, the English translations make such a mess of it that there is some support for these ideas, but only from the English. So there are these three approaches, through three schools of thought regarding the timing of the rapture. Now, the Theology of Grace Doctrine Church, as I've just noted, subscribes to the doctrine of the pre-tribulational rapture. There are a number of passages we referenced in support of this belief, but they're not germane to our subject. However, you must assume from the outset of this study that we are approaching 2 Thessalonians 2 from this viewpoint. Now, a problem in the King James Version's translation occurs in verse 2 and leads to a great deal of confusion. This verse ends with the phrase that the day of Christ had come. I'll repeat the entire verse for you if you're not working from a King James. We ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled either by spirit, word, or letter as if from us. It's the supposition is it's from us. It is not. Don't be troubled by it. And what is the message? According to the King James, as though the day of Christ had come. This is absolutely wrong as far as the translation is concerned. The Greek word for Christ, and I've made a little chart to facilitate things here, the problem of the day in 2 Thessalonians 2:2, what day is this? It says the day of Christ here. Well, the vocabulary is important. This word here shows you the Greek that is transliterated kurios, and it means Lord. And, therefore, day of the Lord is a phrase that means, it's a term, that means the tribulation in this context. We'll note in a moment that the day of the Lord actually refers to, generally, anything that occurs that involves the tribulation and the millennial reign of Christ, the second advent, of course, coming between the two. So the day of the Lord is the tribulation, second advent, and millennium. That is the day of the Lord. In this context, it refers to a specific timing within the day of the Lord. It is the tribulation. Now, this word here is the Greek word that is transliterated Christos and means Christ. The phrase day of Christ is a moment in time called the rapture. It is not a long extended period as is the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is the tribulation, second advent, and millennium, or certain portions thereof indicated by context. Our context is going to reveal Day of the Lord refers to the tribulation with emphasis on the second advent. Day of Christ always refers to the rapture. Now these terms are technically different, as I have noted, and the Day of Christ refers to an instant in time at the rapture of the church, and it is found in Philippians 1:6, Philippians 1:10, Philippians 2:16. And the event is described in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 50 through 57, and 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 13 through 18. Now again, the Day of the Lord includes the tribulation, second advent, and millennium, and includes, therefore, can include 1,007 years of human history. It is also used for any portion of this period, the context indicating how long. And you can consult several passages to see its varied applications in context. Isaiah 2:12, Isaiah 13:6, Joel 1:5, Joel 2 verse 1, Zechariah 4 verse 1, 1 Thessalonians 5 verses 2 and 3, 2 Thessalonians 2 verse 2, our passage, and 2 Peter 3 verse 10. Now, in the context of 2 Thessalonians 2, the phrase, Day of the Lord, refers to the tribulation, with emphasis on the second advent. And now we need to clear up the problem of the King James Version's faulty translation. Let's go back to this chart right here. You will note, first of all, that Christos is translated into the English by the proper noun Christ, and Kurios is translated into the English by the proper noun Lord. The Day of Christ refers to the rapture. The Day of the Lord refers to the tribulation. The phrase found in the Greek of 2 Thessalonians 2 verse 2 is shown here. Here's the way it looks in the Greek. Hei hamera tu kurios. The transliteration is seen here as it's pulled into the English, and here is how it will be translated into the English. The Day of the Lord. The word is kuriu. Kurios means Lord. Day of the Lord means tribulation. The phrase found in the English of the King James Version is the Day of Christ. That's your English translation. The phrase required in the Greek for such a translation is hei hemera tu Christu. And there is your English transliteration and would come out the Day of Christ or the Day of the Rapture. And it's very important that you understand that the English translation of the King James is wrong and it throws emphasis away from the tribulation with emphasis on the second advent back to the rapture of the church. And the people in Thessalonica have been told, you have missed the rapture, many of them thought. You are in the tribulation, and the second advent is at hand. And that was the implication that they said Paul had indicated to them, and that, of course, was a lie. Now, the King James Version's translation causes a problem because it has Paul telling these believers not to be mentally distressed because the Day of Christ or the rapture is at hand. Let me read this again. Verse 2 in the King James. We ask you not to be soon shaken in mind or troubled, even by spirit, word, or letter, as if from us, as though the day of the rapture had come. He had already taught the doctrine of the imminency of the rapture in 1 Thessalonians 1:10 and 1 Thessalonians 4 verses 15 and 17 as something they should look forward to with great anticipation. Why would he say in the second book that they shouldn't be troubled by the idea that the rapture was about to occur? Why would they be troubled with that? They should look forward to that with great anticipation. So it would make no sense for Paul to turn around and tell them in 2 Thessalonians 2 that they were not to be shaken in mind, to be troubled, that the rapture had occurred or was at hand. And what Paul really alerts them to is that because the rapture is imminent, they have no reason to be shaken in mind or troubled that the day of the tribulation is at hand. If the rapture occurs before the tribulation, and they're going to be taken out in resurrection body, then why on earth are they worried or troubled about the tribulation? There's no reason to be. You won't be here. You will be in heaven face to face with the Lord. You will be going through the royal award ceremonies of the judgment seat of Christ. There's therefore no reason to be shaken in mind the rapture is about to occur, or shaken in mind that the tribulation has already occurred. That is an impossibility according to what he has already taught in 1 Thessalonians. So the rapture is imminent. That is true. And if it is true the rapture is imminent, it is also true that the day of the Lord, the tribulation, is also imminent by application. But the good news is that before the tribulation can occur, the rapture has to occur first. Now let's note 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 16 and 17. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a loud command, and the voice of the archangel, that's Gabriel, and with the trumpet of God. This is a biblical signal for a congregation to assemble. It can give signals for movements in battle if warfare is the context. The context here is the assembling of the congregation. When it came time to have city meetings where the citizens were called forward for discussion of an issue, certain trumpet sounds were played, and therefore the citizens of the community would gather in the public square and the issues would be discussed. That's called an ecclesia, an assembly. Ecclesia, translated into our New Testament Bibles, comes out church. You are the assembly. And you've been called into assembly this morning by a regularly scheduled sequence of events. And here we see that the church united, the universal church, is going to be assembled at the rapture. And it's done so by a certain trumpet sound. And it's pointed out here in verse 16. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with a loud command. The Holy Rollers like to say a shout. Well, it simply means that when you are a commanding officer and you give the troops an order, you have to raise your voice. But it's not a Holy Roller kind of shout. It's a voice of command. And then that voice of command is going to signal all of the angels to come to attention. And Gabriel is going to blow his horn, as they say. And so this is occurring right here. This is where Jesus Christ comes down from heaven with an angelic host, an army, and the trumpet sounds for the assembly to come forward. And the assembly is the universal church. And that's what the trumpet's all about. And then you have the sequence of events called the rapture. The dead in Christ shall rise first. That's the physically dead. They will be the first ones to receive their resurrection bodies. And then according to 1 Corinthians 15, a chronon later, verse 17. And then we who are living and remain on earth, meaning the physically alive, shall be transformed into resurrection bodies. And Paul believed in 1 Thessalonians 1:4 that he and the members of that church would be alive when the rapture occurred. We who are living and remain. He had an idea in his mind, absolutely correct, that the rapture was imminent. What does imminency mean? It means it could occur at any moment. There is no prophecy that must be fulfilled before the rapture may occur. Therefore, when it occurs is God's timing. We don't know what that timing is, and therefore we must assume with Paul it may occur at any moment. He assumed it would occur in his lifetime, as is pointed out in verse 17 here. And then we who are living and remain on the earth shall be caught up together with them. Them, meaning the Lord Jesus Christ, the angels, and the dead who have just received their resurrection bodies. And then Zappo, a moment later, those of us who are alive and remain on the earth, we shall receive our resurrection bodies and we shall go up. We shall be lifted up with them. Now the word here is harpazo. That's H-A-R-P-A-Z-O, harpazo. And that is the word that is translated caught up together. It means to take away suddenly. The English word rapture is actually taken from the Latin translation of the New Testament, and the Latin word here that translates harpazo is raptus, and raptus means to carry off. And in the English, your translation for the word rapture is to be carried away. So whether you use the Greek harpazo, the Latin raptus, or the English rapture, it has to do with being lifted up and carried away with them, with Christ and the resurrected dead, in clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we shall always be with the Lord. Now, analysis, therefore, verses like this indicate the imminency of the rapture. And so the imminency of the rapture is clearly stated not only in this passage, but also 1 Corinthians 15, verses 50 through 57. The fact that it must occur before the tribulation begins is made clear in the Greek of 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 3. However, its clarity is not evident in the English translations, and thus it becomes a source, it became the source of the question from our earlier study. So in paragraph 2, let's note what precedes the tribulation. Is it apostasy or is it departure? What precedes the tribulation, apostasy or departure? 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 3 reads this way. This is the King James Version. Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. Certain things need to be pointed out in all of your translations. We can note this by observing first the King James. The words, that day shall not come, are noted in italic font, indicating that is not in the original manuscript. Further, you should also note that the words falling away translate one Greek word, apostasia. A-P-O-S-T-A-S-I-A, apostasia. And we will note that in a few moments. But the apostasia must come first before something else may occur. And what that something else is in that ellipsis. Now let's note the New International Version. Some of you may have that. Here's how it reads. Don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the man doomed to destruction. In the NIV, the words that day will not come are contained in a parenthesis. And apostasia is translated in that version by the word rebellion. New American Standard reads this way, if you have that. Let no man in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first, and the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction. In the NAS, the words, it will not come, is in an italic font indicating an ellipsis. These words do not appear in the original manuscript. And further, apostasia is translated by the English word apostasy. Now, the word that is the source of our discussion is the nominative singular of the Greek noun apostasia that you see on the board. It is translated falling away in the King James, rebellion in the NIV, and apostasy in the New American Standard. In our earlier study, we translated apostasia with the English word rapture. Thus the question, how on earth did you get rapture out of falling away, rebellion, and apostasy? That's the question. And I think it's a good one. And I guess I should have anticipated this. But we had studied this, but I went back and looked, and it was back in something like 1991. So most of you were not even here, and some of you were not even alive in 1991. So we have to go back and do this again to clear up this question, which is a good one. I'm looking at my Bible here, and it says the apostasy has to occur first. And you're calling that a rapture? Yes, I am. So the answer is discovered, first of all, from an exegesis of verse 3. And we don't have time for that now. But this is a good place to stop. Our congregational meeting has thrown me a little behind here, so this could actually go until Hanukkah. But it won't. There are the pages right there. We can get this done either today or maybe Tuesday, and thus answer the question. But it will take an approach here of going into the verse and seeing precisely what it says from the Greek and then bringing it into a best translation in the English. And we'll begin that process at 10 till the hour. In the interim, we'll have our usual prayer meetings. You're dismissed.